Science. You can find traffic and more. We don't want more. We just want a little bit of traffic. Hi, Julie Deppish.
Sandy, we do have some trouble on the Skyway in San Francisco on eastbound 80 at 4th Embarcadero. It's a two-car wreck. They were blocking. They're on the right shoulder now, waiting for the tow truck. It's backed up to 101. There's a wreck in Hayward, northbound 880, just before the 92 interchange. A couple cars may still be in the left lane, trying to get that to the right shoulder. Your backup starts at Whipple Road. And over on the Sonol Gray, northbound 680 under Andrade Road, two-vehicle wreck. They've just cleared that. Traffic getting better from Sheridan Road. Julie Deppish for KQED.
All right. Thanks, Julie. Support for KQED comes from Landmark College, offering academic and social coaching support for neurodivergent individuals at the Bay Area Success Center. Learn more at landmark.edu/successcenter. Good afternoon. I'm Sandy Althaus. You're listening to KQED FM San Francisco, KQEI FM North Highlands, Sacramento. The time now is noon.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Asma Khalid.
I'm Vipa Fernandez. It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Biden is in France for D-Day celebrations, while former President Trump holds his first campaign rally since being convicted. We'll discuss in our weekly roundtable. Also, Palestinian-American artist Samia Halabi's first American retrospective was cancelled amid her criticism of Israel over the war in Gaza.
Painting is not about my feelings. As a painter, my contract was with my society.
We visit Halabi in her art studio. These stories and... Summer's almost here, so it is time to talk about what might be the 2024 Song of the Summer, coming up on Here and Now. The news is first.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Hunter Biden's daughter Naomi took the stand for the defense today in her father's trial on gun charges in Delaware. Hunter Biden is charged with lying about his drug use when he bought a gun in October of 2018. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
With her father at the defense table and her grandmother, First Lady Jill Biden, watching from the front row, Naomi Biden was on the stand for less than an hour. She told jurors she saw her father in August of 2018, around 2 months before he bought the gun at the center of this trial. He was doing rehab, and she said he seemed great. But on cross-examination, she acknowledged she knew her father struggled with addiction, but said she never saw him use drugs and wouldn't be able to tell if he was using them. After she stepped down from the stand, Hunter Biden gave his daughter a hug as she left the courtroom. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, outside the federal courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware.
Still under a cloud of conflict of interest concern, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's latest financial disclosure report includes two luxury trips paid for by a GOP mega donor in 2019. According to the report, Thomas says information was inadvertently omitted at the time of filing. It lists Thomas and his wife as Harlan Crowe's guests during a trip to Bali. Justice Thomas acknowledges he was also Crowe's guest at a private club in California. The report was filed in mid-May but publicly disclosed today. A temporary pier the U.S. military built to deliver humanitarian aid to Gaza is reconnected to the beach in the Palestinian territory where civilians have been starving. Here's NPR's Tom Bowman.
The pier was operational starting May 17th, but was only moving humanitarian aid for a little over a week before a severe storm caused the pier to break apart. Pieces of the pier were towed to an Israeli port for repairs. Now ships loaded with aid from Cyprus are expected to arrive at the pier in the coming days, officials said, and then trucks will move from the pier along a causeway to the beach.
That's NPR's Tom Bowman reporting. Federal investigators are calling for more safety technology in response to a growing number of close calls on runways across the United States. NPR's Joel Rose reports that's one of the recommendations approved at a meeting this week.
The National Transportation Safety Board says an air traffic controller's mistake led to a near collision of two jets on a foggy runway in Austin, Texas last year. Jennifer Homendy, the chair of the NTSB, says critical safety technology might have prevented that incident and others.
The somber truth is it only takes one. One missed warning, One incorrect response can lead to tragedy.
Hammadi is calling for more surface detection technology so that air traffic controllers and pilots can know the precise location of planes on the ground. There have been more close calls on runways across the country in recent years, including one just last week. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. San Jose is set to pay $350,000 to settle a lawsuit filed by a woman who was kicked and dragged by a San Jose police officer in a violent 2020 encounter caught on video. KQED's Joseph Jiha has the story.
The San Jose City Council will consider a settlement with resident Guadalupe Marin at its June 11th meeting. In a complaint filed against the city, Marin says she was in a car with her family in a McDonald's parking lot when two officers approached with their guns drawn. Officers believe the car had evaded police earlier that week. Marin denies that claim. After Marin was already kneeling outside the car with her hands at her side, an officer kicked her in the stomach, pushed her to the ground, and arrested her. He then grabbed her by the handcuffs and dragged her toward the patrol car. Marin's attorney says she was, quote, objectively not a threat to the officers. I'm Joseph Jiha, KQED News.
A San Francisco teacher is going public with concerns that the school district isn't taking the use of racial slurs on campus seriously enough. Levert Holmes teaches at John O'Connell High School. He says there have been multiple incidents since last fall where students, some black and Latino, addressed him using an anti-black racial slur. Holmes says there have been some attempts at discipline, but he doesn't think the district has a plan to address what he sees as a systemic issue.
What I hope to happen is, one, an open dialogue with administration and students being held accountable.
The district declined to comment, but in a message sent to faculty last month, it said it is aware of instances of racism and takes the allegations seriously. I'm Brian Watt. Thanks for listening to KQED News.
Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF, presenting Company, the Tony-winning Best Revival of a Musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works. At the Orpheum Theater, now through June 29th. Tickets at BroadwaySF.com. Sutter Health, with birth centers that never stop delivering joy and cancer clinical trials that never stop delivering hope, Sutter never stops caring for Californians at all stages of life. Learn more at SutterHealth.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
And I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's here and now. In France, this morning, President Biden said U.S. Army Rangers who scaled the cliffs of Normandy on D-Day 80 years ago were summoning the people of today, asking, what will we do as we face bullies on the world stage?
They're not asking us to give or risk our lives, but they are asking us to care for others in our country more than ourselves. They're not asking us to do their job. They're asking us to do our job, to protect freedom in our time, to defend democracy, to stand up aggression abroad and at home.
In Arizona last night, former President Trump, in his first official campaign stop since his New York felony conviction, focused his remarks on what he called an immigration crisis.
Before we defend the borders of foreign countries, we will secure the border of our country. I think that makes sense.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us now to talk about all of that and more. Eugene Daniels is a White House correspondent and co-author of Political Playbook and joins us from Washington, D.C. And Tolu Olorunipa is White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post and joins us from France. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for coming on.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us.
So I want to begin with this speech that Biden gave today in France. It was there abroad to an international audience. But was this really a speech meant for a domestic crowd? And I ask that because it feels hard to ignore the politics in this moment as Biden is running for re-election and democracy is a major theme of his campaign.
Yeah, I can start. Everything that Biden does from here for the next 5 months has a domestic angle, and this speech
had a very clear domestic angle because he's running for re-election. It dovetailed with the major central themes of his re-election pitch, which is that he needs to be re-elected to save American democracy, that Donald Trump poses a major threat to American democracy. Now, he didn't mention Donald Trump by name during the speech in France, but he made very clear references to the fight to save democracy, the sacrifice that Americans need to make, and the need to remember all of the sacrifices that were made by the veterans who fought in World War II and all the other wars in order to save American democracy. And so there was a very clear message. It was very much in line with what he is pushing for his reelection bid as well.
And, you know, there are many comparisons floating around right now, contrasting the speech with that of Republican President Ronald Reagan 40 years ago on the same spot. That's kind of regarded as the gold standard of presidential oratory. And that was 5 years before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Why did Biden even want to make that comparison now? What's striking about it, Eugene?
Yeah, I mean, part of this is exactly what Tulu said, is that this is a president who wants to, at every in everything that he does, create a split screen, right? And Reagan, Ronald Reagan, is the president that you talk to almost any Republican in public life right now, it's who they will say immediately when you ask who's a president who was either the best president or the best Republican president. Some of them will probably say Donald Trump, but most of them would say Ronald Reagan. And so he is trying to, one, reach across the aisle to some of those moderate Republicans, some of those independents who might lean Republicans. You can think of them as the Nikki Haley voters from this primary. That and say to them, you know, the guy that you revere so much, I am trying to do the things that he was doing. I am trying to bring democracy to places that don't have it. And more importantly, protect democracy in the places where it feels like it is on the attack, including here at home in the country.
You know, Eugene, I have to ask you, does that run the risk of alienating the left flank of Biden's base if he's aligning himself more closely with a former Republican president?
Yeah, you know, the left has been angry with Joe Biden his entire political career at different points. So yes, the answer is absolutely yes. At any time that Biden has done over, you know, as president over the last 3.5 years, any of the bipartisanship, any of the reaching across the aisle, you see the left being quite upset. That hasn't changed and that won't. But I think his campaign, this White House, has made a calculation that that is where Donald Trump is squishiest, right? Those white women in the suburbs who often vote Republicans, who have been turned off of Donald Trump for a very long time. And they think those voters are probably more likely to vote for him than others. And I think often Democrats think the left doesn't have a ton of choices if they want a supporter in the White House on the things that they want to do. And so they kind of sometimes don't have much of that choice.
I want to ask you, though, about this message of democracy, because I would make the case that in certain ways, both Trump and Biden, I would say in very different ways, are trying to say that democracy is at stake in this election. Last night in Arizona, Trump spoke about appealing his conviction in the New York hush money case, and this is what he had to say.
And those appellate courts have to step up and straighten things out, or we're not going to have a country any longer.
Tola, what do you make of this contrasting message? I mean, one is making the case about democracy. The other seems to be too, I would argue, but in a sort of personal way.
Well, both candidates are trying to rally their base. They're trying to get people excited. And they're saying that this election is not about me as a person. It's about something bigger. It's about American democracy, about fairness. If you're coming from Trump's perspective, fairness in the justice system, and trying to say that if you don't take action and vote, that you are going to be complicit in allowing the American system, America as we know it, democracy, the justice system, to devolve into something that is unrecognizable. And so both are trying to appeal because they want to rally voters. They want people who are telling pollsters that they don't really like the choice they have before them. They don't really like both of these candidates. But both of these candidates need people to show up and vote. And they are trying to make this about more than themselves, about the democracy, about the American experience overall.
You know, and one of the things that comes out of the Trump conviction is this cacophony of Republicans willing to condemn the whole justice system, as Trump is doing, because of this verdict. I'm wondering, either of you hearing from anyone in the Republican Party these days calling out Trump for this rhetoric?
You have some folks who have. You have folks like Larry Hogan, the former governor of Maryland, who's running in the Senate. You have the people who are always going to do that, the Mitt Romneys, the Liz Cheneys of the country, and of the Republican Party, who are going to continue to do that. The problem is they don't have pool in the Republican Party, right? And so they're mostly talking to moderate Republicans who are already turned off by Trump. They're mostly talking to Democrats who are all, you know, obviously aren't fans of Trump either. And so it is the, you know, the position really of the Republican Party as it stands right now, that there was, you know, a mess afoot, controversy afoot in what happened to Donald Trump when he was convicted by a jury of his peers. And there's almost nothing that anyone could probably say to a lot of those voters and a lot of the leaders of the Republican Party other than Trump to make them change their mind, even though there's no evidence that foul play or there was the hand of Joe Biden or George Soros in this.
I want to shift gears and ask you both, actually, about the trial of the president's son, Hunter Biden. In Delaware today, federal prosecutors rested their case against Hunter, who is accused of lying about his drug use when he applied for a federal gun permit back in 2018. And in an interview this week with ABC's David Muir, Biden was asked if he'd pardon his son.
Will you accept the jury's outcome, their verdict, no matter what it is?
Yes.
And have you ruled out a pardon for your son?
Yes.
That strikes me as a rather stark contrast with the former president, Donald Trump, who has promised to pardon people criminally charged in connection with the riot on Capitol Hill on January 6th. What do you make of that riot and the way that it's now being interpreted and the sort of faith broadly in the justice system? Can I start with you, Tolu?
Well, President Biden wants to create that split screen that Eugene was talking about. He wants to compare himself to Donald Trump, who not only has said he'd pardon his political supporters and did pardon a number of his political supporters while he was in office, but has even floated the idea of pardoning himself for crimes that he is being charged with. And so President Biden wants to show Americans that even my own family members are subject to prosecution. I am not going to interfere with the system of justice. I'm going to follow these traditional norms that we have in this country, and maybe win over some of those Reagan Republicans and moderate Republicans who are comfortable with the idea of Donald Trump talking about retribution, talking about using the Justice Department to go after his enemies and reward his friends. And that is really why you're hearing from Biden such clear language about not pardoning his son and being independent from the justice system. I think you'll hear more of that as we get closer.
I mean, it's got to be worrying for him, though, I imagine. I'll get to you in one sec, because I want to point out that the First Lady was in court in Delaware this week before she left for a quick trip to France to join her husband. But their son's legal trouble isn't something, you know, that we've heard President Biden talk about much. How worried is he about a prison sentence? I mean, this can't be good for him right now.
No, he is very worried about it. Me and some of my colleagues reported a couple of weeks ago before the trial started that he has talked to aides and family members about the concern he has, the fears he has that his son might go to jail, right? This is not the only case, right? There's another case that is pending that's much more kind of serious that's coming up. And he's worried about it. His aides are at times concerned how it might kind of engulf and take over the way that he is operating on the campaign, not so much as president, but like on the campaign. But at the same time, he has tried to stay out of it publicly, but he and his son talk every single day, sometimes multiple times a day. There's no reason to believe that did not continue and has not continued this week. Obviously, as you said, Dr. Biden was there for 3 days, so she obviously talked to her husband about the things that were going on. And so the weight that it has on President Biden is something that he even told people about in a statement that he released on Monday via the White House, saying, I'm a dad. I'm also the president. I'm going to stay out of it. But this is also about my family. Yeah. And so he's trying to balance that as we move forward with the next very stressful 5 months for the entire country.
Very stressful. So much more to talk about, but we are out of time. Eugene Daniels is White House correspondent and Playbook co-author for Politico. And Tolu Olurunipa is White House Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
President Biden won Nevada in 2020, but it was a nail-biter. This year, younger voters are pretty upset with him about cost of living, among other things.
It's like, angering because it affects everyone. Like, how, I'm 23 years old, and I don't think I could afford to move out on my own anytime soon into my own apartment, let alone my own house.
Could Trump take back this crucial state? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, coming up at 1 o'clock, and then at 2...
When two Iranian government officials began resisting the regime, they were imprisoned and then forced to flee to Turkey. One died under unusual circumstances. The other, left heartbroken, is trying to understand what happened. Next time on The World.
The World, 2 p.m. Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF, presenting Company, the Tony-winning best revival of a musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works, at the Orpheum Theater, now through June 29th, tickets at BroadwaySF.com. And Sutter Health, with birth centers that never stop delivering joy and cancer clinical trials that never stop delivering hope, Sutter never stops caring for Californians at all stages of life. Learn more at SutterHealth.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Museum of Science in Boston, dedicated to inspiring a lifelong love of science in everyone, in museums, classrooms, and online, offering engineering design challenges, digital experiences, live presentations, and more. MOS.org.
It's Here and Now. Every summer, we have got that one jam, that one song that truly embodies the vibe of the summer.
Oh, it's getting hot.
Y'all probably remember some of those hits. They were the songs of the summer from back in 2002, 2006, 2007, and 2012. The song of the summer is catchy and pretty much inescapable. And sure, this summer has only just begun, but I'm already so curious what will be the song this summer. Joining us now to walk through some of the top contenders is Kelsey Weekman. She's senior internet culture reporter with Yahoo News. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So first off, Kelsey, we have got to get this out of the way. How exactly does one choose a song of the summer? I mean, is there an actual definition? Is this a somewhat arbitrary situation based on vibes? Lots of questions here.
Yeah, vibes are definitely important. It is an actual quantifiable measure of the song that was the most popular, counting stream, sales, radio play, between Memorial Day and Labor Day. That's like the actual definition.
Okay.
But it also serves as the song that kind of captures the summer vibe. It's what you hear at cookouts and bars and at the pool doing your summer activities.
All right. So has there been or can there be more than one song of the summer?
Technically speaking, sure. But there's really one that is the actual most popular. Like, we can quantify that. So, like, spiritually, there might be a few, but analytically, there's just one.
Got it, got it. Okay, so let's talk about the potential top contenders for this year's Song of the Summer. Our producer, Kalyani, is convinced that it's going to be Sabrina Carpenter's Espresso, which has been everywhere. So, for folks who don't know, let's take a listen.
Now he's thinking about me.
All right, so what are your thoughts, Kelsey? Is this really going to be 2024's Song of the Summer?
We are starting off strong because this is my favorite song vibes-wise. I think this is summer. It's an earworm. It's a really interesting story behind it. Sabrina Carpenter, who sings it, has been kind of on the cusp of superstardom for a very long time, and this could be what sets her over the edge, but it has not yet hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 just yet. It's still kind of up in the 3-4 range. And so with a little bit of radio play and maybe some viral moments, it could take number one and it could take the summer.
All right. Okay, well, while we are on the topic of pop songs, there's also Chappell Roan. She has seen an almost meteoric rise in popularity recently, and her song Good Luck Babe might have a chance.
I don't want to call it off.
Another situation where we've got someone on the cusp of superstardom and really breaking out. Chappell has this new song that is really blowing up on TikTok, getting a lot of momentum. It's not in the range that Espresso is quite yet, but there are a lot of people rooting for her. And as every day passes, she becomes more popular. So it could be a kind of dark horse candidate for a Song of Summer.
All right. So we are still, I would say, relatively early in the season of summer.
Right.
You know, how much do we actually know at this point about what songs will be popular? I mean, it's possible there could be a surprise hit that we don't even know about yet, because some folks do have new songs, new albums coming out later this summer.
Totally. So what's actually really interesting about this year that makes me think that record companies are aware of the race for Song of Summer is that many of the biggest pop acts like Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande, Dua Lipa, release their albums ahead of the summer. So enough that you can get your plays in and figure out your favorites before Memorial Day.
I feel like this is like Oscars, right? Where all the movies now come out at a certain time to make sure they get Oscar nominations, it feels like.
Pretty much. And that's really interesting for music. It doesn't usually happen.
You mentioned this idea of going viral. And it does seem that some songs go up in the charts after gaining traction online. Take Tommy Richmond's Million Dollar Baby. It is sort of inescapable on TikTok. So how much does going viral online really matter for a Song of the Summer?
It definitely matters. It earworms, again, are a huge part of what drives a summer song. If it's not inescapable at, you know, barbecues, it might be inescapable when you open your phone. And songs of summer past haven't really been the biggest TikTok songs. They've been kind of more low-key in years past, especially since 2020. I'm thinking about how, you know, Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush became such a huge smash after Stranger Things and TikTok, but it didn't break through. It wasn't quite big enough to be the Song of Summer. But I think that now that everyone's on social media and it's so ubiquitous, we might see TikTok really driving whatever ends up being number one.
This also makes me feel incredibly old. I feel like I'm very much dating myself. But when you talk about this idea of a Song of the Summer, you mentioned barbecues. Like, I think of when I was looking at the old list, I think of the songs that were really, like, when I was in college, they were played everywhere in public places, right? Like, whether you were out physically at a mall, whether you were just hanging out in a cafe, no matter where, you'd hear the song physically, collectively, everywhere.
Yes.
Because there was no concept of, like, individually streaming music. And now, because people can stream it all online, I'm just wondering if it affects the way that we choose the Song of the Summer, or, like, how we coalesce around a song is so different.
So when I think about some of my favorite songs of summer, I think about One Dance by Drake or Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And those are just songs that you can hear blasting from someone's car or out and about. Like, those were songs you really couldn't get away from. And now, since so much of what's popular is driven by what we're streaming in our houses during the workday, what's Song of Summer isn't always necessarily ubiquitous like it used to be.
It's not as much in, like, the public sphere, it feels like, right? Like,
right.
We can have different vibes of what a Song of the Summer is.
Yeah, it's less of a shared experience for sure.
So we do seem to also be living in this moment of country music resurgence. Post Malone's duet I Had Some Help with Morgan Wallen, who, by the way, sang last year's song The Summer, went straight to number one on the Billboard Hot 100 the week after it was released. Okay, and the reason I wanted to ask you about this song is I am curious if there is something different about this summer's mood compared to summers past, and is what is trending right now, does it say something about like who or where we are as a country and just what folks are feeling?
It has shifted, I think, the vibe for Song of Summer, especially last year. Morgan Wallen's Last Night was far and away the analytical number one song of summer. And now this Post Malone collaboration with him, I definitely think if I'm putting my thinking cap on, my analytical cap on, I think that's just got to, it's probably going to end up being number one.
Really?
But
well, tell me more. Why?
Yeah. So it's just, it debuted at number one and it didn't need the kind of lead in, the people getting used to it, the pickups on radio play just immediately kind of charged in there. But I think we've been being set up for having a huge country music moment. We've got Post Malone and Beyonce, like you said, releasing country projects. We've got a new folksy country singer in Zach Bryan who has a big song out too. And there's even this really popular song right now that I also think could be a contender. That's the country take on the song Tipsy from like 20 years ago by an artist called Shabuzi. And there's just a real country music vibe going on.
What's behind that?
I don't really know. I think definitely a lot of pop stars leaning into country roots and collaborating with country artists might introduce country music to people who are usually more on the pop side of things. And I don't know, I just think that summer's a great time to listen to country music. You think about the outdoors and doing stuff outside, you often think about country.
All right, before we let you go, Kelsey, I just want to ask, what is your top choice for this year's Song of the Summer? We'll play out on it.
Espresso. I hope Espresso wins. I'm streaming so that Espresso wins.
You and Kalyani, our producer.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
That is Kelsey Weekman, Senior Internet Culture Reporter with Yahoo News. Thanks so much for joining us, Kelsey.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Now he's thinking about me.
Live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. The prosecution has rested its case against Hunter Biden, who is accused of lying on a federal gun purchase form when he said he wasn't using drugs at the time he bought a revolver in 2018. Prosecutors say the president's son was actively using drugs around that time and purposefully lied on the form. They called his ex-wife and former girlfriend to testify that his drug use was habitual. Defense attorney Abby Lowell has said he did not believe he had a serious drug problem at the time of the gun purchase and that there was no attempt to deceive anyone. President Vladimir Putin says Russia will consider sending weapons to adversaries of the West. He did not say what countries or entities he was referring to, and he stressed that Moscow is not doing it now. He said today if other countries supply weapons to the combat zone in Ukraine and call for using those weapons against Russia, why doesn't Russia have the right to do the same? A U.S. military-built pier designed to carry aid into Gaza by boat has been reconnected to the beach in the besieged territory after it broke apart in storms and rough seas. U.S. Central Command said today food and other supplies will begin flowing in the coming days. The pier, a section that connects to the beach in Gaza, was rebuilt 2 weeks after heavy storms damaged it. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from Xfinity. Customers can get wall-to-wall Wi-Fi that extends coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. Want to stay informed on top of Bay Area news stories? Sign up for KQED's News Daily Newsletter at kqed.org/newsletters for a roundup of key local stories delivered every weekday.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And Luma Sales, working to fulfill the investment needs of institutional and retail clients worldwide by integrating proprietary research and risk analysis to develop a customized approach for each investor. LumaSales.com.
It's Here and Now. Throughout this weekend, you will see houses on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., from tiny homes to big ones, built in hours. It's a showcase to highlight new ways to make housing cheaper and more plentiful. And as NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports, these innovations have real urgency as many Americans struggle to find an affordable place to live.
On what's normally a wide-open, grassy space on the National Mall, halfway between the U.S. Capitol and the Washington Monument, a small, temporary village is sprouting. A forklift goes by carrying a tiny house, and workers assemble what looks like an instant log cabin. This is the Innovative Housing Showcase, staged by HUD, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development.
What a great day to be in America's front lawn, isn't it?
That's Acting HUD Secretary Adrian Todman. She says this event is about showcasing the future and expanding the country's housing supply.
And one of the ways that we know to bring down costs is to just build more housing. Am I right? Just build more. Build, build, build.
After the speeches, I walk into the house that served as the backdrop, a bright, stylish, manufactured home, what used to be known as a mobile home.
This is the first single-section duplex approved by HUD.
Richard Smith is a sales manager at Cavco, the company that built this home. HUD sets national building standards for manufactured homes and recently changed its code to allow homes like this. Smith explains why making a duplex manufactured home matters.
It allows us to get more affordable homes, two living areas in one space, especially for infill areas. So it really just helps just a piece of solving the affordable housing crisis.
He says one reason they're here is to show that homes like this can have a place in more urban areas, and they continue to meet real needs elsewhere.
Especially in rural areas, this is really the only opportunity for folks to have new housing. You just don't have the tradespeople, the developers that want to go into smaller, more rural areas. So that's a real niche that we serve, but we can serve a whole lot more than that.
Further along the mall stands a traditional-looking house that wasn't here 2 days ago. It's two stories and is ready for siding and a roof.
Hi there.
Mark Cyrus works for 84 Lumber.
So we framed a house that's off-site manufacturing. So it was trucked in and done a little under 6 hours, start to finish.
So wait, what's the innovation here?
So the innovation is the floor cassettes that are pre-manufactured off-site, the longer walls with windows in them, and then the roof cassettes. So when it comes in, it's literally they're not building nothing. They're just putting together like a kind of like a puzzle.
With typical stick framing, it might take 2 weeks to do all this. But here, using these materials, like the pre-built flooring sections, have cut that time way down. That's a big deal because for developers, the time before a project is completed costs big money. And that gets passed along to the home buyer.
For builders, it's all about cycle time. Cycle time is how quick you can build a house.
And the faster they can build the house,
the more affordable they can give houses to the American people.
Expanding the country's supply of housing will need a lot of solutions. And faster, cheaper methods like these are one way to move the needle. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Washington.
And now a milestone in cricket.
The red, white, and blue of USA has overcome the 2022 finalists.
That's Willow TV as the US cricket team shocked the world with its win over Pakistan at the T20 World Cup in Dallas yesterday. As a high school cricket player, I was a leg spin bowler, for those who cares. This is so exciting. How's that? It's here and now.
I'm crushing on me.
You call them self-love pop bangers?
Yeah, self-love anthems, yes.
All about what motivates Meghan Trainor.
I write these anthems for myself, but also for strangers out there.
Meghan Trainor's new album, Timeless, and the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I've been singing these love songs all to myself, bought a blue bag from Tiffany's.
Civil rights leaders Art Johnston and Pepe Peña are a force behind LGBTQ plus equality through their iconic gay bar in Chicago. You can catch the story of the long struggle for equality and their fight to love freely in a new Pride Month special of Art and Pep Monday night at 9 on KQED 9. And support for KQED comes from Berklee Repertory Theater, presenting Octavio Solis, Mother Road, an epic 21st century journey along Route 66 inspired by John Steinbeck. Playing through July 21st, more at berkleyrep.org. And Hassler Heating and AC, advancing California's electric initiatives by converting homes to heat pump technology. For installation or repair of heating and cooling equipment, visit hasslerheating.com.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and Landmark College in Vermont, offering summer programs for high school and college students to help discover their learning abilities and help achieve academic and social success. In-person and online options, more at landmark.edu/summer. And WBUR with ZSP Media, presenting Beyond All Repair, a new podcast investigating an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything and everyone. Listen now.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Asma Khalid in Boston.
I'm Deepa Fernandez in Alameda, California. It's Here and Now. Samia Halaby is a painter, sculptor, and activist. Her art is in the collections of the Guggenheim in New York and Abu Dhabi, among many other major museums. You could call her one of America's premier artists, but that's not how she would describe herself.
Thank you for considering one of the premier artists, but you wouldn't have known that about me if it weren't for the cancellation.
As she points out, more people know her name and her work now because of Indiana University's decision to cancel her first American retrospective. The university, which happens to be her alma mater, said it had, quote, concerns about guaranteeing the integrity of the exhibit for its duration. Halaby is Palestinian-American. She's been an outspoken critic of Israel's war in Gaza, which has killed over 35,000 people, according to the Gaza health authorities. The exhibit was cancelled several months ago. She's not sitting around waiting for the next opportunity to create more. At her home and studio in Lower Manhattan, she's contemplating her next piece and her activism. Here and Now producer Gabby Healy pops in to see for herself.
Hi, it's Gabby from Here and Now. I'm going to buzz in. I'm ready to come up, but I wanted to ask you if it was okay if I'm rolling right away.
Hi. Samia Halaby's home is bursting with color. The studio is cavernous. It's a loft big enough to be her personal space and a creative one, too. Natural light floods in through the windows. The space feels warm and welcoming, not just because of the tea and snacks she offers me. There are a few big abstract paintings hanging on the back wall. They're full of vibrant greens, pinks, and blues.
This painting reminds me of sitting in an olive tree, although it doesn't look like an olive tree, on a fresh afternoon with beautiful light. But what I was trying to do was...
So Halaby is an accomplished painter. She's also a pioneer. In the early 1980s, she used computers and programming to create digital pieces, some of which were included in the planned retrospective. The exhibit included work spanning 60 years.
Gabby, I'm going to take you to the front room and maybe
She's in her late 80s now. She was born in Jerusalem and was one of about 750,000 people displaced, most of them by force, when the State of Israel was created in 1948. Palestinians call this the Nakba. It means catastrophe in English. Halaby was just 11 years old when her family was forced to flee.
It was a sudden shock and the beginning of an ongoing Nakba that I experienced all of my life since then. The greatest pain for me as a child was watching my generation of my parents suffer so much. I was a child and I could adjust, but as time went by, their sufferings began to permeate my own life.
She says Israel's war on Gaza has brought back those memories from her childhood.
As I see the people suffering, I remember my own loss as they talk about their homes gone. Mine still exists in my imagination, although its content was sold in flea markets in Tel Aviv, its furniture pilfered, and the house was divided and lived in by Jewish immigrants to the then newly established state of Israel.
Her family first fled to Beirut. When she was 14, they moved to Cincinnati, Ohio. She studied at Indiana University and Michigan State University and later taught at Yale.
It reminds me of the graffiti you see, you know? And the graffiti is where the kids can reach.
As we wander around her apartment, she talks about her approach to painting.
To me, painting is not about my feelings and my personal expression. As a painter, my contract was with my society, and I owe my society sharing information and extracting from what I see as the most advanced thinking of my society. But old-fashioned painting may not be able to contain the new thinking. So I'm trying to create new paintings that will contain the thinking of my society and the most advanced elements of my society, not the backward ones.
I ask her who that society is.
It's the future. People who are now 5 years old, they're the future of my society. And these are some of the challenges, but this one here, which is just came back from being exhibited.
And as we move around the studio, following the chronological progression of Halaby's career, we arrive at a work called Sun from 2015. It consists of small pink and yellow X's. The X's appear close together at the center of the painting, and the density seems to decrease as your eye moves to the outer edges of the canvas.
I was challenging myself to make a painting that's basically yellow and blue. There's touches of orange and touches of green, but very subtle variations. And I was doing that to describe the relativity of light and color in abstract painting.
Even in this stage of her storied career, she's still experimenting with color, trying to demonstrate the different ways our eyes perceive color at different times of the day.
When I wake up in the morning, if it's very early and still dark outside and I trot through here with a low level of light, the yellows are very dark. They're not luminous like this. They're not looking like sunshine.
This painting serves as a visual reminder of the survival skills we obtained as hunter-gatherers. She describes how our perception of color, hues, and shades helped to stay alive. She's a natural teacher, conveying what her own professors explained when she was a student. As I'm standing in front of the painting, I see the scientific rationale behind her work. But of course, her creativity goes far beyond painting. We look at some figures made of papier-mâché. Other pieces hang down from the ceiling, like vines or seaweed.
So now I'm going to show you another artwork here.
Okay.
And these are artworks that are made out of papier-mâché. Mm-hmm. And
I've never seen art in such an intimate setting before. Taken together, her work invites me to slow down. But we are talking at an urgent time when it feels hard to be cheerful or have an abstract conversation about art. That's because artists in Gaza are at risk due to Israel's bombardment, and some have died. One of them is Fethi Gabin, a Palestinian painter and educator. He died in February. He was famous for incorporating the Palestinian flag into his artwork in the 1980s, when depicting the flag was illegal. Israeli authorities would not allow Gabin to leave Gaza to be treated for a chronic chest and lung issue, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Culture. And for the artists who remain, Halaby says a generation of work has been ruined.
There are other artists in Gaza, tons of them, whose studios have been completely destroyed, who's hardly able to go rescue one painting out of them. And they are established artists as well internationally.
Amid all this loss, a lasting peace still feels far away. But for now, Samia Halaby is still speaking out about conditions for Palestinians and tending to her work.
Glad to see my fixing worked here.
How is it damaged before?
They had it packed in a way that...
And to return to abstraction, one of the main themes of her artistic life, Halaby is aware of the juxtaposition in her art. It's playful, but with a heavy context.
I get the feeling is, how can you be a Palestinian and be so angry and upset about things and still be optimistic and happy? Your paintings are happy. And they are optimistic and happy.
She says she's found a sense of self-reliance and respect in a world that she feels doesn't respect her. And as a Palestinian, it seems like she's living that duality of anger and optimism every day.
Optimism is very political, is very advanced. To be optimistic means we are sure what the future will bring. And I am sure those who are forward-looking will in the end win over.
And it doesn't seem like she's losing a lot of sleep over the cancellation of her retrospective.
To me, it's not a very important loss. It's a loss that I wasn't able to talk to the students about ideas of what abstraction could be and what it is. It's too bad. But I still continue to function.
And at Indiana University, protests continue. A student encampment there is one of several that emerged this spring. Among other demands, students are pushing the university to divest from Israel. And earlier this year, students at Michigan State University also called for their school to divest. That campus will host another version of Samia Halaby's exhibit at the end of this month. For Here and Now, I'm Gabby Healy.
And to find a wide range of perspectives, news, and analysis, go to npr.org/Mideast Updates. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Repertory Theater, presenting Octavio Solis's Mother Road, an epic 21st century journey along Route 66, inspired by John Steinbeck, playing through July 21st. More at berkeleyrep.org. And KQED's Bay Curious podcast, a show answering listener questions about the Bay Area, features fun trivia questions in each episode. Listen and enter to win cool prizes at kqed.org/baycurious, sponsored by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. And listen to KQED throughout each weekday for clues to our 5:48 p.m. news quiz. When you hear the quiz question, go to kqed.org/radionewsquiz to enter your answer for a chance to win a two-night stay with our sponsor, Canyon Ranch Woodside. And good luck.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from your NPR station, from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. And Rhodes Scholar, a not-for-profit educational travel organization offering adventures for adults in more than 100 countries. Learn more at roadscholar.org/explore.
It's Here and Now. The game show Wheel of Fortune is closing a long chapter.
Ladies and gentlemen, here are the stars of America's Game. That's St. Jack and Dana White.
Tonight's the last time you'll see the two of them together in a new episode, because after more than 40 years and 8
1,000 episodes, Sajak is retiring from Wheel of Fortune. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to mark the occasion. Hey there, Eric.
Hey, I'm feeling really old because I remember when he started.
No way. Okay, so when did he start? Because Pat Sajak is 77 years old, and I will confess, for as long as I have been alive watching the show, he has been on.
I know. Well, see, I used to watch the show when I was at home, sick from school and things like that, right? So I actually remember when the show changed over. He started in 1981.
Okay, so it was before I was born.
Oh boy, you're really making me feel old. Now we got a clip of his first appearance where he was filling in for host Chuck Woolery.
Please do not adjust your sets at home. Chuck Woolery has not shrunk. As Jack mentioned, my name is Pat Sajak, and I've been fortunate enough to wander onto the set of a very successful program, has been for a long time.
And so I remember being a little dismayed, like, who's this new guy taking over for Chuck? You know, but of course, then Pat went on to blaze his own trail on the show and earn a really long legacy.
So why is he retiring now?
Well, that's a good question. He's done an interview with his daughter. His daughter is the social media correspondent on the show, and they circulated some clips where he said, you know, he felt like he wanted to leave while he was still healthy and he was still good at the job. He's the last in a certain kind of game show host that you really don't see on TV anymore. And maybe, you know, he just decided it was time for him to step aside in a way that many others before him had done.
What do you think kind of set him apart? I mean, you mentioned that he's the last of a certain kind of old school game show host. I guess I'm thinking of folks like Alex Trebek on Jeopardy. There were a whole bunch of guys who really made this their career for a number of years.
Bringing up again my age, thank you very much. But, you know, back when, particularly when Pat started hosting Wheel of Fortune, you had a certain kind of person who would become the host of these shows, and they would be affable, but they wouldn't necessarily bring their own stardom or their own persona to what they were doing. A lot of times they had started as maybe radio DJs, or they had worked in local television or something like that. And their job was to be inoffensive and to be a little witty and to make the guests look good and move the things along. And Pat Sajak was really great at that. We've got a clip of him dealing with a contestant who knew the show so well that he was doing all of the things that normally a host would tell him to do. Huh. And then Pat had a priceless reaction. Let's listen to it.
Yeah, there you go. Now
I like money. What? Yeah! I like the song. I before E, except after C. Woo!
There's really no need for me at all.
So, you know, that was sort of his goal, was to bring out the contestants a little bit so that people could bond with them and enjoy, you know, what they were doing. If there were any awkward moments, I mean, people might remember just a couple of weeks ago, a contestant gave a kind of risque answer inadvertently to a puzzle, and he kept things moving, things like that.
So for the record, his on-screen partner, Vanna White, she is sticking around?
She is indeed sticking around. It was it wasn't for sure when he announced that he was retiring whether she was going to stick around, but she has signed a deal to stick around for at least a little bit. And the two of them together, almost, they have this vibe of sort of like a very friendly, avuncular couple guiding you through a game. And she's talked a little bit about what it's like to work with Pat Sajak. Here's a clip from a Good Morning America interview.
We called ourselves Ken and Barbie. I mean, we're not quite that today, but Ken and Barbie go together and always have.
And the two of them, of course, have had a chemistry that's endured for more than 40 years.
Eric, I am curious why Vanna White isn't taking over and becoming the main host here herself. I mean, because I feel like I have never or so rarely seen a woman actually host a game show.
Well, certainly among these classic game show hosts, they were almost all men. I mean, you know, talking about the Bob Barkers from The Price is Right or the Monty Halls from Let's Make a Deal, during that generation, I mean, you'd have to go back to, like, I guess maybe Betty White. But You know, that's a question for both the people who produced the show and for Vanna White. Would she want to do that? And did they seriously consider having her do that? It is a separate skill. And, you know, there's no guarantee that she really wanted to do it. The other thing is that the person who's going to succeed Pat Sajak is Ryan Seacrest, the host of American Idol. And he is, not to cast any shade, but he is younger than both of them. And so maybe there's a sense that they wanted somebody who could, again, host the show for many, many years. But that's a very good question, and it's certainly worth putting to the producers of the show.
That's NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. It was great to speak with you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Here and Now. It's a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Asma Khalid.
It's been wonderful to have you with us this week, Asma.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thanks. I've really enjoyed my time.
And in our last piece of breaking news for the week, our dear colleague Robin Young, just out of successful shoulder surgery. We miss you, Robin. Heal quickly. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com.
Well, despite the odds, cassette tapes are making a comeback, and one family-owned company in Springfield, Missouri, is a leader in the revival. We'll hear that story coming up on All Things Considered, which starts in just a minute. First, Julie Depesch is back with traffic, and we're looking at Hayward.
Yeah, dealing with a storm.